All right, real quick, for those of you listening on Apple Podcast, I do apologize. The first couple of questions that I had, I did not pick up my audio, but rather than cut out that section, I've gone ahead and just cut out the dead space that was me, so that you can still listen to what Matthew Kressel had to say. Hope you enjoy the interview, and thank you for listening.
I passed through spring right to summer. We've got the air conditioners on. Yeah, it's very humid. Yeah, a little more. Yeah, we had a couple days, it was like 2 weeks ago, I think, maybe two and a half, where I was during COVID. And so like, I got COVID and I was like, had the sweats really bad and a fever. And then it's also 90 degrees. And my wife's like, look, I know you're feeling like crap, but we got to put that air conditioner in, you know, for both of us. So we had to do that. But yeah, it worked out. Thank you, by the way, for doing this. This is cool. Well, it's not even known to most Jewish people, I think, either. It's kind of more of the mystical, Kabbalistic side.
Welcome to the channel. My name is Edward, also known as Griftkin here on Twitch.
About half an episode
below, there's a little heart-shaped button. That is the follow button.
For the end of Stranger Things.
Click on that. Helps you find me later.
Binged it this week.
Also, there is a subscribe button.
So we got about 30 minutes left.
Asking for money. However, if you do have an Amazon Prime subscription, you do get a free Twitch subscription you can use once a month. You want to use that on me and help me?
It's total pure 80s nostalgia. It's just
if you're watching
ripping off
YouTube,
all those, that stuff, but it's fun.
The subscribe button, as opposed to Twitch, subscribe doesn't cost you anything on YouTube. That is their version of the follow button. So feel free to go ahead and click on that. And also, if you're watching this on YouTube, if you liked it, hit the like. That'll also help other people find it. I do appreciate that. All right. Not right now, but if you also want to click on the About button back again on Twitch, it'll give you all of the links to all of the different social media, which would also lead you to the YouTube channel where all of these interviews will be put up about 24 hours after the Twitch stream. Come on in. Hope you enjoy it, and I hope everybody has a nice day.
The other one's fine. Matt is fine. I feel like Matthew is like my mother's like Matthew. But you know, at cons, everyone's like, "Oh, hey, Matthew." I'm like, "Okay, now we paint worlds." Thank you. There you go. Thank you. That's Moksha. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a software, it's a manuscript submission system. So publishers use Moksha to accept online submissions. So I think it was about a decade ago now, it might be 11 years ago now, John Joseph Adams, who is the editor of Lightspeed and Nightmare magazines and various anthologies, approached me and said, "Hey, Matt, I know you have a submission system. I was wondering if I could use it." So before that, from 2003 to 2010, I published a zine. It's called Sybil's Garage. If you were around then, you may have heard of it. A lot of authors that are still writing today have had their first stories in it. These zines are really popular. It was like right around the time that like desktop publishing, so to speak, got really easy. So before that, you need to have, you know, expensive software, expensive computers, and a publishing house. But then, you know, it got to the point where you could do it on your desktop. So I published this zine for 7 years, magazine, and we got lots of accolades and honorable mentions and stuff. So, you know, being a programmer, I was like, getting submissions via email is difficult to do if you have, let's say, 8 slush readers. So I programmed this thing, which was just basically a round robin where, like, you know, the first submission goes to reader A, then reader B, C, et cetera, and then round in a loop. It was a really simple thing. And then I added some small features. It wasn't that good or featureful, let's say. So when John Adams approached me, I said, "Look, John," I said, "you don't want this system. I'm going to make you something from scratch." So that's what I did. I built, that was the first version of Moksha. I think that was around 2011. That ended up working really well. And then a few years after that, I don't remember the exact date, probably, I want to say it's around 2014, 2015, maybe, I rebuilt the whole thing from scratch again. And then, you know, since then, more and more publishers have begun to use it. Uncanny magazine uses it, Tor.com, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Strange Horizons, a bunch of others. Is right now there's, it's almost like 100 different publishers. I mean, some of them are like active and non-active, but I think in 2021, we accepted about, when I say accepted, I mean, received about 100,000 submissions in the year. So Moksha processed all those submissions. It's been steadily growing and it's been fun. And it's interesting to, like, you know, I constantly do work on it, but it's really stable. So I could go a day or two or three without working on Moksha. And then I just, like, some days I wake up in the morning, I'm like, wow, there's like thousands of authors that are using this system. And it kind of blows my mind because I forget about it. But yeah, it's global. It's accessible by anybody in the world. I mean, that, and it's free. So if you're familiar with Yog's Law, it says money should always flow to the writer. And that's one strict rule we have with Moksha. I never will charge submission fees. Sometimes I get like these, you know, college journals, and a lot of them, or just literary journals, and a lot of them, their business model is to charge authors a submission fee. So you pay like $5 or $10 to submit your story to these magazines. And there's a lot of opinions about this in the writing world, but I am of the opinion that this is a tax on the writer. So I am strongly against it, because I feel like it discriminates against people who can't afford it or don't have access to, for example, a credit card. I mean, what if you're in a part of the world that you don't have easy access to credit, or, you know, you don't have, like, maybe $5 in the United States or Canada or UK is not that much, but maybe in a part of the world, it is a lot, or even if you're in those countries and you can't afford it. So I'm strongly against it. So I only charge the publishers. I don't charge authors, never do. And so, you know, occasionally we'll get people that want to sign up for Moksha, and I tell them this, and they're like, oh, all right, you know, we can't do that. But overall, it's been, I think it's been really good for publishers. I think most people really love it, and authors too, I think, because it's easy to use.
Well, yeah, and if you've got that many people using it, I mean, I think it's a little bit of a pat on the back to you, at least. The fact that, you know, somebody came to you and wanted to use it, and now it's like, you know, more and more and more and more companies. The downside is with the name on it, I mean, it's like, I'm not sure where you're getting the credit, you know, like, it should be the Cressel system, you know?
Well, I mean, I have copyright, yeah, right? I have a copyright on it. So, like, you know, there's, if you look on the site, it's just copyright Matthew Cressel, but also M-O-K those are my initials, Matthew Owen Cressel. So that's where, and then also Moksha is a, in Hinduism and Jainism, is a term for the cycle of birth and death. So
gotcha.
Liberation from the cycle of birth and death. So the idea is, like, it reminded me very much of submitting stories to magazines, right? It's this constant cycle, and you're just hoping for escape from the cycle.
Well, and it's fun too when you can work your own initials into something like that. It's like that's a perfect fit. And of course, I'm only teasing a little bit. After all, as you can see up here, my username is Griftkin on here, so, you know, hey, it's like, right. It's not exactly like I've got my name on everything either. And then also another thing, you know, I could ask you about fantastic fiction, but I feel more like I need to ask you about KGB Bar.
Okay.
That's just a fun title there.
Yeah. So, yeah, kind of unfortunate name at this point. So
right.
the bar actually is owned by a Ukrainian Jew, and he's in the 50s during the McCarthy period. It functioned as a kind of speakeasy for Ukrainian socialists, and the current owner is Denis Wojcik, and I'm not sure if he's the original owner, but basically it's like, it was Soviet kitsch. Like, after the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, after it collapsed in what was this, 89, 90? So the bar, like, was founded in 93, because it was like, oh, remember this, the Soviet Union, that country that collapsed? So it's like they filled it with Soviet era paraphernalia. So they had like the big hammer and sickle mm-hmm. flag, a Lenin statue, and they had actual like stuff from the Soviet Union, you know, on the walls, and they had like stuff that was probably pretty valuable. Some of it's been stolen over the years.
So, of course.
So it's actually became a very popular literary venue in New York City, and New York Times says it's like one of the best literary venues in the city for live readings. And so there's different nights of the week, they have different things going on, like poetry, fiction, not all of it's speculative fiction. So in the late 90s, Terry Bisson, I'm sure you're familiar with Terry, and Alice Turner, who was the fiction editor of Playboy, got together and they wanted to kind of bridge the gap, so to speak, of genre and literary fiction, sort of, because they felt that they were paving the same road. And the series morphed later into just mostly spec fic, you know, science fiction, fantasy, and horror. So it had different hosts over the years. Ellen Datlow came in, Gavin Grant and Kelly Link were hosting for a while, and then Gavin and Kelly couldn't do it anymore. It was too far for them. So I stepped in for them. And then I've been doing it with Ellen since, I think it's 2010. I've lost track, actually. So yeah, like if you go there now, we took a hiatus for the pandemic. We did it online. We like this,
yeah.
which actually ended up working out really well for us, because we were able to get authors from all over the world. Usman Malik, who was in Pakistan at the time, Lauren Bucus, who was in South Africa. We had authors from Barbados, Australia, you know, people who couldn't come physically to New York could be on our show. That was really great. And then we went back for briefly, then there was a spike in COVID cases. Now we're back again. But if you go to the KGB bar now, they have like a big Ukrainian flag up. You know, they took down the Soviet flag and the big Ukrainian flag hanging outside there. The region in the city where the bar is actually very Ukrainian. And in fact, my wife used to go to the church there when she was a kid. She's Ukrainian. So yeah, it's a really great series in that, you know, you get a lot of regulars, but you also get people who are kind of new to the scene, so to speak, and not just authors and editors and agents, but fans, like people who say, oh, I want to see my favorite author read. They come there.
Oh, yeah.
And then they, you know, they meet other people who have similar interests. And it's really great to see how friends form. And, you know, I made a lot of friends through the bar. And, you know, New York City is such a transient city. People come in, they leave. So I know a lot of people that I used to see at the bar now don't live in the city, which is kind of sad. But yeah, if you're ever in New York City on the third Wednesday of the month, come gotcha. To the Fantastic Fiction reading series. I kind of dropped the KGB from the name.
Well, yeah.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, it's
but it is at the KGB bar, which by the way stands for Crane Gallery Bar, not whatever the Russian name is.
But it's still it's a cool, I mean, obviously not in this moment in time, but you know, if you go back 2 or 3 years, I would have gotten a kick out of the name KGB Bar, because, you know, obviously long after the Soviets had fallen, before Russia went on their little current psycho thing, you know, it just kind of had that nostalgic feel. And again, I think you use the word kitsch, but it's, we kind of look at it with a paint of humor about it now, as, you know, obviously we know that the KGB was bad, but we kind of look at it more through the lens of a Maxwell Smart or something now, you know, kind of, you know, bumbling spy ring, stuff like that. But like I said, you knew way more about the KGB bar than I was expecting, which I actually appreciated. I like the background on that. And again, I'm the same way. I'm sure everybody's the same way. They see KGB bar and the first thing they're going to think of is what the, you know, Russian KGB, not the actual name of the bar. But I appreciate that. And the fan fiction, I love that too. The fact that you talked about the fact that during the break you get to talk to these people, because I think I told you in an email that we sent back and forth, I worked at the Bookworm here in Omaha and absolutely fell in love with author events. But, you know, let's face it, not every single author necessarily wants to stop in Nebraska. You know, it's not the, you know, beehive of the literary world, although we have had a lot of big names come through. But that's kind of why I opened this up, especially when it stopped happening, because, and rightly so, for the last couple of years, people haven't necessarily been big about, you know, being in closed spaces and in large groups, or, you know, flying, you know, in little tiny tubes of compressed air to get there in the first place. Yeah. So, you know, I've been able to talk to you. I've been able to talk to people from, you know, Massachusetts. I managed to hit Seattle twice. I didn't even know they were both from Seattle, but kind of all over the place. And I feel like readership, not just a fandom, but to a certain extent is a tight knit community. Most of the people I know, there's not a lot of fair weather fans when it comes to books. You're either obsessed to the point of, you know, possible psychosis / hoarder. We will not discuss my to be read pile. Or you get the people who's like, eh, I'll wait for the movie to come out. There are some people in the middle, but I feel like it's a very small subset. And so just the fact that I almost had to start this for myself just because I missed that interaction with the authors.
Yeah.
I didn't host the authors at the store, but I met a lot of them and I just love sitting down and listening to them. And I know I'm not supposed to probably give shout outs to other groups that do this, but I will give a shout out to the Poison Pen. They're actually a store, and they do way more of these author interviews than I do because they have, you know, multiple people that can do them and they're paid to do it. I've gotten some of my, can't think of the word I'm looking for again. It's a little bit of my fix from them sometimes, cause I'll have some of my favorite authors on and it's kind of fun to hop on. But again, too, is it's to bring, hopefully somebody's going to see this that would not have known about your book otherwise at some point. And hopefully I can, the best compliment I think you can give to any author is to recommend their book to somebody else, and not because you're a morning, you know, radio host who's been said, hey, so-and-so's come in, we need you to talk to this person for 5 minutes, who you realize 2 minutes in has never read their book, but somebody like a bookseller or something like that is like, you know, I read this book, I liked it, we're going to talk about it, this is why I think you'd enjoy it. And so hopefully that's a little bit of what we do here. So I apologize. This title will not stick in my brain. Paint the universe.
Now we
paint worlds. And I think it's the fact that I can't get universe out of my head. It's like, that's not the right name. Now we paint worlds. I'm actually, because I don't want to ruin the ending for anybody, I'm not going to talk about what the subject of that book is. I think you know very well what the subject of is. It's one of the best books I've read on that subject, or books, short stories. And I say it's one of the best books I've read on that particular subject because you wrote it in such a way that you don't realize that's what the book's about until we get to the end. The fact that it's to a certain extent all about perception. Like I said, I don't want to get in. You know what the word I'm trying to avoid is, just because I don't want to give away that ending to somebody else who's reading it. But
can
you know,
I set up the story? Maybe that yes. will help if people haven't read it. So it's called Now We Paint Worlds. It's on tor.com. So if you look on their fiction, I think it's technically a novelette. I forget the exact length. So the setup is that three planets. So it's a, you know, about, I would say 800,000 years from now, humanity spread to several hundred planets around the galaxy. Three planets mysteriously vanished. They just literally vanished. And there's this organization called the Free Trade Union, who's responsible for basically making sure that there's peace between worlds by making sure that there's constantly trade. And so a representative of this union, her name's Orna, is sent to this kind of backwater planet that has just been terraformed. It's maybe just a few years old, doesn't have, the population's very small, to investigate basically a hermit who, rumor says that he keeps boasting that he's responsible for the missing planets. So the setup is that she is there to investigate this person, very skeptical that some hermit on a mountain is responsible for this, but that's how the story begins. So,
and trust me, I'll tell people it only gets better from there. I find it kind of funny too, but it's probably way more true than I want it to be, that you've got this situation where entire planets are disappearing and somebody's claiming, you know, ownership of that, and bureaucracy is going to send some low level person to, like, you know, just check this person out and not, you know, check them off the board.
Yeah.
Instead of putting an actual, it's like, you know, he's taking claim for it. Maybe we should at least, you know, maybe he's a, don't get me wrong. Again, I'm looking at it from the beginning of the story. Maybe he's a kook, but he's the only one that seems to have any idea what's going on. And of course, I also find it funny too, that it's not the people that you would think of that would be normally worried about millions of people. It's the people who worried about trade, you know, the Trade Federation. That's the one that gets involved, because, you know, now money's getting in, it's at stake.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the basic philosophy is that as long as you keep trade between worlds, as long as everyone has their material needs met, there's not going to be any war or minimal risk of war. That's the theory, at least. I should also point out that this story is linked to some of my other pieces of fiction. It's in the so-called, what I call the Newmanverse, N-U-M-E-N. And if you go to my website, you can see a list of stories, but that are in that world. One of them was published in Inner Zone, I think it was like 2010, it's called Saving Diego. One of them was published in Lightspeed about 2 years ago, called Still You Linger, Like Soot in the Air. And that was also reprinted in Niels Clark, Year's Best. A few other stories. And I'm actually at work on a novel right now that is contemporary with Now We Paint Worlds.
Okay, so nice.
So the events of Now We Paint Worlds happen while the events of the novel are going on. So you see it from a different point of view.
Gotcha. All right. I noticed you didn't say you were working on book three of World Mender, but okay. But getting into World Mender, and actually the first question I've got for you is kind of maybe not what you would think, but again, we talked briefly earlier, the fact that World Mender touches on a lot of Jewish/Christian/Islamic theology, you know, to a certain extent, some would say mythology. I would say more like along the facts of a lot of the non-canonical stories that are out there. Mm-hmm. And there's, don't get me wrong, there's plenty of that and everybody knows it. Some of them, you know, very familiar names, most of which I'm going to pronounce incorrectly, but for instance, Azazel, your everyday X-Men fan's going to recognize that one because he's been made into an evil character in the X-Men universe. But some of the other ones, and what was the name of that group again? The Mikulalim?
Mikulalim, or the Mikulal. So it's, yes. It just means the cursed in Hebrew. It just cursed.
Yeah. A Google search for that only brings up your books. I'm just telling you that.
Really? So, you know, okay, cool.
So, like I said, some of them, you had some in there that were at least, you know, mainstream enough to, you know, catch people's interest. And some other ones were like majority of people are probably going to go, you know, that I have no idea who this is.
Well, some of it, in all honesty, was made up.
Well, I was kind of hoping so a little bit. Some of that. But, do you find, and I ask this a lot of writers who do this type of stuff. I had one that did some alternate history, historical fiction. Actually, I called it alternate history science fiction. But when you have that thing where you weave in known entities, you know, characters or something, you can still do your own take on them. But it's something that somebody's like, hey, I recognize that name. I know who that is. Do you find that it's easier when you write a character like that because there's already that base model of it? Or do you find it's harder because sometimes you're like, okay, this is who this character is, but I want them to do this thing that they wouldn't normally have done in the quote unquote actual stories?
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. So I obviously did a lot of research for King of Shards and in terms of the mythology. I was reading a bunch of texts, even going back to like the source biblical stuff and apocryphal stuff, like the Book of Tobit, which is, I think it's one of the first references to Ashmedai. And, you know, Ashmedai actually shows compassion in that and empathy. And that was, I was like, oh, a demon is having empathy because he knows someone's going to die in the morning, right on the day of his wedding. And he gets sad. And I'm like, oh, like, I actually like the idea of like a demon having empathy, like that was kind of the impetus for this. So I think, you know, you've probably heard this expression, like two Jews, three opinions. if you ask anyone like these interpretations, like, and this is like a very Jewish thing, and I'm not going to go into like religious at all, but just in terms of like the study of Talmud, for example, there's usually like several opinions on something. There's a question and then there's like 10 opinions. And then there's like the bottom line, that's where the term comes from, is like the head rabbi or the chief rabbi would say, here's what we think. But they discuss this, there's a million opinions on it. So, you know, when you're researching the source material, it's going to quote like two or three places, but a lot of it's subject to interpretation anyway. So I kind of found that what these, you know, Torah commentaries were doing was in a way kind of like Torah fan fiction, right? So they were taking these biblical stories and they were taking like one sentence or even one word and filling in these huge gaps just from the way they interpreted that word or that sentence or the phrasing of the positions of word. And it's kind of amazing at how they are able to kind of dissect the text. So when you look at some of these myths, you'll see that like the quote where they the line where they get it from is like, well, that's not how I would have read that. But that they did, and then they interpreted it, and then they created entire, you know, mythologies around these things. And, you know, everyone kind of also assumes that, you know, you're like, oh, well, you know, Hindu culture and Islamic culture and Jewish culture and Christian culture. And we sometimes can think of these things as like being mutually exclusive, but we forget that there's oftentimes ideas are shared. You know, there was trade going back thousands of years. I don't know how true this is, but I've heard stories that Jesus may have spent time in India. So, you know, my point being that you got all this like interweaving of ideas so that you'll see things that show up in Judaism that may have been Christian ideas and vice versa. And the idea of like rebirth, which is a, you know, reincarnation, which is a, you know, more of an Eastern tradition, you know, Buddhist and Hindu, shows up in certain Kabbalistic texts. It after a while, when you start to write this stuff, you realize that there is no kind of central source text, the authoritative text about some of this stuff. So, you know, at some point I'm like, all right, I have to be, you know, as a writer, I have to be true to the characters, not to whatever the myth is. So I do deviate from some of it, including like you said, Azazel, you know, which really that comes from like in the Yom Kippur ceremony, you know, the Day of Atonement, which is the holiest day of the year for Jews. Traditionally, there were two goats, and they would sacrifice one to God, and then with the blood of that one, they would sprinkle it on another goat and send it off into the desert to Azazel. So that was like, that was basically like casting the sins out of. So the idea was like, you know, you'll be purified of your sins because the goat will be sent out. And that's where the idea you get where goats are evil, right? So that you're casting the evil goat, the sin goat, the scapegoat out into the desert to Azazel. So this, like, there was a lot of theories, like, what is Azazel? And they're like, oh, it's a demon. And so, yeah, you know, just playing with some of these ideas. And the Mikulalim were just something I completely made up. There was like a kind of couple analogs that I found, but nothing quite matched what I wanted for those beings. But a lot of the other stuff is spread in many, many different texts.
But I appreciated that too. I think sometimes, especially, and I'm not going to get religious, but for instance, Christians kind of want to think that they're not the same way, but you look at how many different denominations there are. You talk about two Jews with three different ideas, you know, a lot of the other religions aren't any better. You know, there's groups that split off completely over the argument over what one word means or another. Mm-hmm. I also think, again, going to throw myself under the bus, I've done enough reading that I recognize some of the names, but for instance, like Azazel, the average Christian's not going to recognize that because in most of the, at least English speaking, is not going to recognize that because it's been translated in most of the Christian texts. I believe it's desert or wasteland. It's not Azazel. Yes. They've picked a word and they've made it something. As to where, on the other hand, we also have other words, and again, this ties in because you mentioned them late in the book, but Nephilim. That's like one of the weird ones that we've just never translated to anything, and it's just Nephilim. And some people think they were giants. Some people think they were dinosaurs. Some people think, as you had in yours, that it's a cross between, you know, demons and humans because of the whole, sons of God, daughters of men. So, you know, they kind of put that together. Yeah. But there's nothing that you can look in the Bible and says, okay, Nephilim means this, and this is what it says. Doesn't matter whether you're in a Jewish text or a Christian text or, you know. So I think to a certain extent, and again, you're writing a story. I don't feel that there's any problem with, as what I like to call, creative license. As long as you're true to maybe the gist of the character that you're using, if you're going to use a historical / religious / mythological character, I don't see that there's a problem with doing that creative license. And I personally actually enjoy some of those, because basically you're looking at, you know, you're looking at somebody else's idea and take on it. Not every discussion, I think, has to be a true 100% theological, intellectual discussion. Like I told you before, with C.S. Lewis and what he did with Narnia, he made a story out of it.
Yeah.
Overall, he took the Bible story as he saw it and he put his own take on it. And yet, I don't feel like there's a lot of people, at least maybe there was at the time, but modern people, nobody really has a problem with Narnia. But sometimes other things get taken in. Like I don't know if you saw it. There's some movie that's being, they're trying to ban it right now because... not here in the U.S., but some movie was trying. They're trying to ban it because people are upset because it has the daughter of Muhammad.
I heard something on the news, but I didn't. I'm not sure, or maybe I'm thinking of something else. But
it was pretty recent. I just noticed it in the news today myself. I just thought it kind of funny because it tied kind of the thought I had for this. But yeah, this is always my downfall on some of these books, is there's certain questions you can ask and certain questions where, like, I don't want to give this away. I did like the nothings that you put in at the end, too. I won't give anything away on that. People will get to it when they get to it. But the fact that, you know, they truly are nothing to an extent. You can't see them. You can't, but you can hear them. They can talk to you. Obviously, but they also, these are like the ultimate, you know, leave it the way you found it. You put footprints in our desert, we're getting rid of you.
Yeah.
So those were an interesting take. Was that something that you borrowed from another idea too?
I stole it from myself.
Which is fine.
So I wrote a story called The Bricks of Gelecek, or Gelecek. I'm not sure how I even pronounce it. It's actually a Turkish word that means legacy. And so it was a story that I wrote for an anthology called Naked City, which came out, I had it up on my screen here, in 2011. So Rana, in the book, without giving too much away, is, let's just call her, a creative spirit. Mm-hmm. The Bricks of Gelecek is about a creative spirit like Rana, a young woman who also a mason, a bricklayer, and she's singing, and one of these beings of nothingness gets charmed by her voice and falls in love with her. But kind of like Midas, you know, he's a being of nothingness, anything he touches is destroyed. So yeah, that was I stole that from myself, and in fact, if you read that story again, you'll see that it takes place on Gehinom, or it's another name for Gehenna, which is the same world as King of Shards takes place. So,
well, I know you said Rana too, so that's another, sounds like another character you may have stole from yourself.
Yeah, Rana is basically kind of the same character in the Bricks of Gelecek, the same girl. They're basically the same character. I like that character a lot, and I wanted to bring it back, but there's certain differences between them. I think Rana, because in the short story you can only really flesh out the character so much, and I think in the book Rana's you get a lot more of her character
and gotcha. Backstory. So would you say the short story is canon, or do you think it was just a story that you borrowed from to make the larger story?
When you say canon, I mean it's definitely
connected.
It's connected to King of Shards, but I wouldn't say necessarily the Bricks of Galacek didn't have a lot of that Judaic mythology that King of Shards has. So, you know, the premise of King of Shards, which I should say, I'm not sure if your viewers or listeners are familiar with it, but there's this idea, it's called the Lamed Vav. So there's this idea that like there are 36 saints, pillars that sustain the world. And if not for their righteousness, God would destroy the world. So in King of Shards, demons basically figure out, oh, and the other thing about these Lamed Vav, these 36 saints or pillars, is that they don't know that they are in fact pillars. They're so anonymous that even they are anonymous to themselves. They're to themselves are just ordinary people. But demons somehow find out who they are, and they want to destroy the Lamed Vav. They want to kill them. Why? Well, what happened was our world, the universe that humans live in, is not the first world. There were others, but God shattered them, and their shattered husks lay throughout the cosmos. And on these husks, demons dwell. They're called shards. That's where the title comes from, Kingdom of Shards. And so Gehinom, one of these worlds, is a hell shard. It's where demons live. Humans live there too, but that's where demons live. So without giving too much away, demons are pissed. They got the crap end of the stick. They got these shards. They got these hell worlds. They have to struggle to survive. And look at Earth. They got this, you know, beautiful world and planet, and they have plenty. And hey, they're like, it's not fair. So some of these demons want to destroy the Lamed Vav and maybe bring some of that good fortune to themselves. So that's pretty much the premise of King of Shards.
Yeah, no, and I was definitely going to get to that on the shards part. I figured that was, you find that out early enough in the book that I don't feel like you're giving anything away on that. Obviously, anybody who's read enough is going to recognize the Gehenna term, I'm hoping at least. Of course, a lot of the English versions just call it hell now, but Gehenna, especially if you have like an old 1901 American Standard version or something like that, it's not translated. It's just Gehenna. But I actually kind of thoroughly enjoyed that. The fact that you brought up the fact that this wasn't the first world, that's something I always got kind of a kick out of those type of stories too, because even from a purely theological standpoint, looking at, you know, the world here, we know that there are already angels and demons, it seems like, you know, the way you read your Bible, in the Christian viewpoint and in the Jewish viewpoint, they already existed. Where did they come from? You know, are these people from a previous world? And now, you know, we're going on and, you know, God's trying a different tact with the new plan. But those came from somewhere. And I love the fact when somebody takes that type of story and kind of goes into that whole thing about what would these other worlds look like, the ones that preceded ours. Maybe taking a little wind out of our sails, because I feel maybe we get to, well, it's Earth. We live on it. You know, it's ours. We get a little kind of wrapped up in ourselves. You know, there's a reason for, you know, millennia people thought that, you know, that Earth was the center of the universe. And now we know it's not true. But I really appreciated that story. I enjoyed where you went with that story. The other thing that you said, and I don't know if you've ever, did you ever see the movie The Prophecy?
It sounds familiar.
Christopher Walken plays Gabriel. But that's another one where
I think I may have, yeah.
Basically, that movie's been around forever. I'm not spoiling this for anybody, but it's another one of those things where in this case, it's not the demons, it's some of the angels themselves, like Gabriel, who's like, we were with God all this time. We've always been here. We've always done this stuff. And as Christopher Walken's character always calls him, like, now you give these monkeys a place above us, you know, and you're talking about the humans. And so that's another one where, again, I feel like some people could be upset about it, but if you're watching it just for the story, it's a great movie. Movie one, by the way, they made like five of them. 2 was okay. After that, it was like all straight to DVD or straight to VHS. Don't watch the rest of them. I did buy the 5-pack DVD for like $5 just so I could watch them all. I should have stopped at the first one. But so the story that you tell, I at least totally appreciated. Not from a religious standpoint, not from an anti-religious standpoint, just for enjoying the story and the fact that you tied all of these different characters, backgrounds together, and you were, at least I feel, again, I'm not a scholar, I feel that you were true, and of course it sounds like you said you did a lot of research for this, true to the base model while still being able to tell your story, the story that you wanted to tell. And the way King of Shards ends, I definitely got to watch. You got definitely got to read Queen of Static. Is that it? Queen of Static.
Yeah, Queen of Static.
That just came out in March. It's available in paperback. It's available on Kindle. I didn't look elsewhere. I don't know if it's available on audiobook. I don't think
not so. Audiobook yet. I'm working on that, but not yet.
You're probably trying to find somebody who's willing to say all these ancient names and get them right.
I'm working with Audible. Actually released the audiobook for King of Shards, so I'm
I miss that one?
I don't know. They're trying to sell it. I mean, I'm trying to convince them to do one of Queen of Static, but it's a work in progress.
It would have definitely helped my pronunciation on some of these. I'll say that. Side joke, but I used to know a guy that went to the church that I went to, and you could always tell if there was a Bible reading and if it was Old Testament, he didn't want to be picked. He's like, I am not going to pronounce any of these names correctly. You know, there's not a whole lot of Bobs and Bills in some of the. I don't think I'm giving away anything on this one, too. I did totally appreciate anybody who reads the book. They're going to know who Caleb is, also known as Ashmedai. Mm-hmm. But the fact that Azazel calls him Ashy all the time, siblings, what are you going to do? All right. So I can't talk about Queen of Static, at least not with any intellect, because I haven't actually read it yet, although it's definitely joining to my to-be-read list. The way King of Shards ends, I've got to see what happens next. I'm going to ask you, you are more than welcome to say no. Do you have any sort of timetable on book 3?
So I have outlined it. I have outlined it. I've written a synopsis, but I do not presently know when I'm going to be working on that. At present, I am finishing up a novel in my Newmanverse, which is far future science fiction. And I am also, my agent is shopping around a YA science fiction thriller, near future thriller. So, those are really the projects I'm working on now. I was invited, I can't say what yet, but to write a story that takes place in a shared universe.
Oh, nice.
Which is really cool. It's new. Can't really say anything about it, but
which is fine. Don't want to get anybody in trouble.
It seems like it's going to be pretty cool. So I'm excited about that. So though right now that's really where my brain is.
I'm not an author, but I always feel like getting invited to a shared universe is kind of like an honor, but also like, oh crud. Because now you've got to write this thing, but it's a shared universe. So you've got certain parameters you're kind of stuck in.
Yeah.
Don't know if you know who Brian Freeman is. This isn't actually for a segue. This is actually a point, although he will be the next interview I'm doing. I've known him since long before he joined it, but he got invited by the guys who were in charge of the Bourne universe, Bourne Identity and like that. Yeah. And he's the current author. He's the third book in that series is about to come out where he has taken over the Bourne stuff. And I just always feel like especially if you loved what that author's written or you've loved what those authors have written, it's got to be an honor to be asked. But now it's like, this is pressure. You know, this is not me taking my own intellectual property and doing whatever I want with it. This is like this. I'm taking over somebody's well-loved character or well-loved universe or something like that. And now I've got to. Okay, of course, now I feel like I'm putting pressure on you. I'm not meaning to do that. I just feel like it's like thanks, but no thanks. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how I want to go there. I just wanted to be nominated. That's all I wanted.
Well, I mean, I think in this case, it's a brand new world. So there isn't that much canon yet, although they did set up a wiki and they're like, here's the basic framework of the world. It's a pretty wide open world. Like they were very clever in how they structured it. So it's possible to carve out like my own niche in the world.
Gotcha.
You know, my own, I can create my own character. There are certain things you can't do. They have, you know, you can't do X, Y, and Z, but I think it's early enough in the world building where I can be free. But I mean, mm-hmm. I've written a story that is basically takes place in Alice in Wonderland. So that's like a pre-existing world and you really can't do anything with those characters. They're sort of set in stone, but I was like, oh, but you know, there are other things you could do. Like if I introduce another character, then I can do whatever I want with them. So, you know, you can play with it. I think sometimes that having that limitation can actually drive creativity because it forces you to think in different ways. And so sometimes being like squeezed, like, oh, well, you can only do this narrow thing, believe it or not, actually opens things up. It's,
you know, I hadn't thought about that before, but I could see where you go there. For instance, just like in your Alice in Wonderland story, and let's say, for instance, you're having to write, you know, you signed a contract and you've got to write an Alice in Wonderland story. The skill that it takes to make it yours without just rewriting the story, because, you know, if you're going to just rewrite the story, they can just buy the original. But if you, again, like you said, if you deviate, well, first of all, you're not allowed to deviate too far. But if you do, let's say it's something that's, you know, it's out in the public section, because I've seen some people take stories where nobody owns the copyright anymore, for instance, and they do their own take on it to the fact where it's almost unrecognizable and you're just did you ever watch the movie I, Robot?
Yes.
Okay. Have you read the books I, Robot?
Yeah.
They're not connected at all.
No, I know. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, I liked the movie, but if you'd read Asimov's books first, you're like, what?
Yeah. They're just like, oh, let's use the name. I mean that's what these studios do now. They just use the name because they know it'll.
Well, the funny thing, trivia on that, it was actually, that movie was written, and I think it was actually halfway through filming, and it was not connected to Asimov at all. Mm-hmm. They decided they were trying, I think it was a publicity stunt, they were trying to get more of it, and they took it to whoever owns, because Asimov, there's a foundation that owns his rights. And they went to them.
No
and
pun
like,
intended.
Yeah. good one. I didn't even think that. I set that one up. But he took it to him and they're like, you know what? This is more Asimov than Asimov. And they're like, you know, if you want to use the name, sure. So they had to refilm some of it because basically all they did was take some of the characters from the Asimov book. Because I wrote about it was actually a collection of short stories. Mm-hmm. And like, we're going to take these characters' names and we're just going to slap them on the people in the movie. And now it's Asimov's iRobot. It's like, no, it's not. Not saying it was a bad movie, but it wasn't. It was an iRobot, that's for sure. But getting back to the point is, when you do something like that, you're so far off. The people who are in there, who are going to watch it because they love the book, sorely disappointed. They're going to be totally upset at what you did to their characters, or in this case, what wasn't their characters in the first place. But yeah, I can see. I think it takes a special kind of author to do that, simply because, and don't get me wrong, I know a lot of authors and a lot of them would be thrilled to have that challenge, mm-hmm. but you got to go in eyes open. And it sounds like you did. You're going in eyes open with the fact that, you know, it's going to be a challenge. I'm going to write this. It's going to take some effort, but you know, if I get to the other end of that and I'm happy with what I did, you know, that's all the pride I need. Hopefully other people will love it. I think a lot of the times, some of the authors, and not the ones I've talked to, because like I said, I pick very specific authors to do this, but I've seen some bigger authors where I feel like, especially after a certain amount of, if they get semi-famous and the book gets a little bit going, they almost write what they feel they have to write. They write what they think is going to be a bestseller instead of writing the story that they want to. And I'm not going to say an author because I don't believe in throwing authors under the bus. I tease James Patterson sometimes because he's never going to be on here, but I'm not talking about him. There's an author that my wife loved. Mm-hmm. Whenever her new book came out, had to get it. She loved the series. And she's finally at the point where she's like, you know, I don't want her next book, because at this point, she's just writing the same story. It's one of those, like, you know, mystery type things. It's like she's just changing a few places, a few words, you know, change who the killer is. And yeah, you know, it's the same story again.
Yeah, I think, you know, I haven't had that, you know, I haven't been blessed or cursed with that. But I think that if you get really successful with a certain story, mm-hmm. then or story arc, let's say, you feel that you have to repeat that if you deviate from that, if you go in a different direction, you may alienate or disappoint your readers. And that might be something terrifying. I'm going to plug a great lecture series I watched by Alan Moore. Okay. So if you're familiar with the BBC Maestro, like...
heard of it, haven't.
Yeah, it's like...
Don't watch a lot of BBC.
It's actually online. So you've heard of Masterclass?
Yes.
So this was like the BBC's version of Masterclass. And they had Alan Moore lectures for 90 weeks, which as far as like taking a course goes, I thought it was pretty inexpensive. You know, I in the sense of I did not expect much because I watched a few masterclasses and I saw them. I watched the Margaret Atwood, the Joyce Carol Oates one. I forgot what the other one was. And, you know, I thought it was very sort of basic and more of like, you know, your first day you show up for a college class and the professor talks about what they're going to talk about during the semester. That's what Masterclass felt like to me. BBC Maestro with Alan Moore, this was a class. There was so many gems in here. I want us to sit and watch it over again. He's just brilliant. And you know, everyone's like, oh, Alan Moore, he's like a crazy, mad genius. He's a genius, but he's not crazy. And what I mean is he has a very methodical approach to fiction writing. And one of the things he talks about is not getting stuck in a particular formulaic fiction that, you know, it whenever he does something and he's successful with it, he intentionally tries to not do that in his next book. And that's what always keeps him creative and constantly inventing and constantly interesting, in my opinion. But I found that lecture really fascinating and totally worth the $90.
Yeah. I'll throw a link on the YouTube just so people can check it out. I'm not saying go buy it. I'm just saying go check it out. I'll give you the link for that. So usually I try to keep these to about an hour just because I know, for instance, you need to go finish watching Stranger Things.
Yes.
So a little bit of a wrap up. I always ask this of every single author on here. Go ahead and give a shout out to whatever local, doesn't matter if it's a mom and pop independent or if it's just your local, chain, but a brick and mortar store, some place that you appreciate or, you know, maybe give you a start with your book or you go to sign or just, you know, the local bookstore you like to go hang out at.
Sure. I'm going to mention Word Books in Brooklyn. Okay. I think they're called Word Brooklyn. They're in Greenpoint, New York. So I used to live about two blocks away from there and I'd go there all the time. I did some readings there. I've been to many readings there, book parties. And my friend and neighbor upstairs actually plays on a basketball team that they sponsor. There's a basketball court right across the street.
Oh, nice.
But they're a great little independent bookstore and they have a good online presence so that you can order books from them, pretty much anything, and get it shipped to you. And that's in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And one more bookstore that I love, this is in New Paltz, New York, which is about 2 hours north of Manhattan. Mountain regions is like the Shawgunk Mountains there. A lot of rock climbing, really great rock climbing. I don't do rock climbing, but they
I don't anymore.
we do a lot of hiking up there, but the Inquiring Minds bookstore. It's a great used and new bookstore. I think they also have one in Saugerties, New York, but there's a lot of authors that live in the Catskill region up there, particularly horror writers. I know John Langan lives up there, but they have a lot of like local author selections and readings, and then also, you know, new books and really great curated selection. And I just, the used book section, I just wander in the back for hours. So those are my two, probably two favorite bookstores.
Yeah, my family, we can't. Every time we go on vacation, we have to check out at least one bookstore, and we never leave empty-handed. There's always something we can find. I wish I'd talked to you about a decade ago, though, because when we went up to New York, I didn't have any of these recommendations. And the one place that I wanted to go, I kind of yelled at them a little bit. I use the term yelled loosely. They didn't put anything on their website. So we were down there, went over to Central Park. We walked. I'm not a walker, but when we go on vacation, my wife makes me walk. All of my 25,000 step days are on vacation with my wife. But we walked from the hotel we were at, checked out Central Park, and then went over to Rizzoli's, which is Manhattan. And they were closed.
Oh, no.
They were down. I think they were in the middle of moving because the building they had had some non-readers using the walls, if you know what I mean. It's New York. You can put two and two together. But yeah, I was like, man, I was so excited because I always heard about Rizzoli's. I was like, I got to go check out Rizzoli's. And like, the door is locked. It's like, dag nabbit. But yeah, I do love my brick and mortars. I tell people all the time, if you don't have a local bookstore, I have no issue with you going to a place like Amazon, because again, the long term, I want the authors, you know, I want their books out there. Yeah. But if you do have a local bookstore, you know, check them out. Not only are they employing the people in your community, more than likely, if an author is going to stop by to do a book signing or a talk or a reading, Amazon's not going to send them. It's going to be your local independent mom and pop shop. Sometimes it's going to be a Barnes & Noble. As far as I can tell from the little time I worked there, it is never going to be a Books A Million. I worked for a Books A Million for 6 years, and the only author event we had was Dog the Bounty Hunter's daughter. Wasn't even Dog. It was his daughter. Who, don't get me wrong, I'm not picking her. She was the most gracious person I have ever met, and not what I was expecting, because if anybody's ever watched that show, the guy's like, she was tiny. She was a cupid doll, but she was so nice, and not a lot of people showed up. There was a thunderstorm. I'm getting off on a tangent here, but she was so nice. She still showed up. She talked to every single person that was there, took pictures. So I'm not picking on her. I'm just saying, that's part of the reason I started going to the Bookworm when I was here in Omaha, is because every time an author came in, they went to the Bookworm. It's like, how are we the second largest book chain in America? This is obviously after borders shuttered, and everybody's going to the Bookworm. But I think a lot of times authors know that, you know, the chains are there, but the really, not all of them, but a lot of the really knowledgeable booksellers, the people you're going to go to, the people who are going to learn your name, find out what you like, and can give you suggestions based on the customer that they know you are, that's going to be your local independent bookseller. I've told people all the time when I was working at the Bookworm, you know, based on the stuff you're like, I think you're going to like this. If you don't like it, you can come back and yell at me. You know exactly where I am. I'll be here. But yeah, so if you're anywhere near any of these, and I will look those up. I will get the links. If they've got a website, I'll have a link in the Zoom. I'm on Zoom. I'll have the link in the YouTube. But yeah, go ahead and check them out. If you're visiting New York, go ahead and check them out. If you got a couple books to throw out a book, you know, the mom and pop shop may not be able to buy a book as cheap as an Amazon, but your dollar's going to go farther there. You're going to be supporting those people. And like I said, just give them a chance. And like I said, I don't normally go off this tangent on the bookseller part as much as I'm doing today. So, but I do want to thank you, Matt, for being here. I have been super, super lucky. I don't think anybody's going to disagree with me on this. I want to say this is the sixth or seventh one. I know one of them didn't count because my audio went out. That's actually Brian Freeman, who's gracious enough to be coming back when his new book's coming out next month, because they recorded all of his audio and none of mine.
No.
Yes, he could hear me fine in Zoom. Yes. I had his audio going directly into, because his audio, I had it going directly into my earbuds. I had broken these 3 days before and hadn't tried out the new ones. Okay. And I accidentally had his audio go into me instead of into the recording software, which is why I always have the recording software in front of me now, because I can see the little audio mixer go up and down to make sure that the voices are being heard. Yeah. But yeah, every single author I've had, including you, have made my job super simple. You hear all these things about, and I know it's probably still a little bit true, but you get used to it after a while. A lot of authors are a little bit introverted, you know, don't like to get out in public, but every single one I've talked to has been a joy to talk to, carried the conversation. When you can tell by what I'm doing right now, I can carry a conversation if I have to, but nobody's here to listen to me. They're here to find out about your book and listen to what the author has to say. And I actually appreciate it whenever I can just like kind of throw out a subject and then the author, you know, talks for the next 5 to 6 minutes and I just get to chill back and relax and I get to be a fan almost instead of a host. So I appreciate that. Definitely going to read Queen of Static. Like I said, if you haven't read King of Shards, go out there and get it. It's totally worth it. Again, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Maybe I'm a big, huge fan of that which touches on the religious or mystical sometimes, but you know, there you have it. I don't think I'm that biased that I would recommend a bad book. This one was absolutely great. Gonna read Queen of Static, and if we ever find out the name to the third book, which exists currently only in an outline form, definitely want you to check that one out too, because got to see how it wraps up. So I think that is all. Doesn't look like we had any questions or comments in the chat this time around. Hopefully, like I said, this will be on YouTube. Yeah, I'm sure pretty free tomorrow, so I'll probably get this edited down, get all the ums that you've heard me say taken out of there to make myself sound a little more intelligent. I will get this up on there, and then probably a week after that. So tomorrow on YouTube, hopefully, and then sometime in the next week, it'll also be on Apple Podcast. That way, if you don't want to sit at your computer and watch this, you can just, you know, pop it in, listen to it on the go. So again, thank you, Matthew. Totally looking forward to the next books. Definitely going to have to check out some of those short stories that I haven't gotten to yet. Again, I'm going to give a shout out to Tor.com. They've given me a lot of my ideas. If you're not a big book fan, but you do love stories, a lot of the best short stories that I have found have been on Tor. A lot of them, in most cases, these are free, usually books that have been out for a little while. Although occasionally you'll get a short story that somebody will throw out there that's brand new. Check those out. It's always a good little, I call it like the sampler. You get to see if you like an author before you pick it out. Yeah. I did love your short story, which brought me to King of Shards, and I am 100% not regretting that I have spent a very, very busy week doing this with what little free time I had. I absolutely love the book. And thank you. Whatever else comes out, you have an open invitation. You've got my email, probably have my phone number too. I usually put that on everything. I don't know why, but you know, go ahead and reach out to me. I'd love to have you back. Definitely going to try to get Queen of Static read by then, especially if we get back to that third one. I'm only a little bit teasing you. I don't know him, so don't take it. It's like I'm cheesing a friend, but I have been picking on Patrick Rothfuss. It's been like the 10th anniversary of the first book came out, and we still don't have the third one in that series. So you are among some very good names with these slow ones. But as I tell people, if you're trying to make the book as good as the first one or two, I have no problem waiting. The older I get, the less problem I have waiting, because I've just come to the fact now that I am never going to read every book I want to read. I'm never going to watch every movie I want to watch. But I'm certainly going to take my time and enjoy the ones that I do have. All right. So yeah. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, everybody who is watching this. Totally appreciate it. Thank you. Hopefully we will see you again next time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.